Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to look back at the Lost Caverns of Sajkant and our actual play from this past holiday weekend. Does this classic tournament module still stand up today for modern players? What lessons or surprises should we take from our actual play experience? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we begin on our conversation today, I want to remind everyone, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get your account all set up over there before the end of the show, and maybe about 10 minutes or so after, we will be there to talk to you all live. And I also want to take a quick moment also to call out thanks to Kelsey for the lovely bump from our channel. We've recently hit over 3,000 subscribers and a whopping 450,000 total views across the channel.
Yeah.
So really excited about that. Welcome everyone who's new. We are so glad you're here for interesting, intelligent discussion about old school D&D and modern D&D and how the two fit together. If you have friends who are into that, please recommend us to them. We'd love to see you here on the channel, in the chat, and maybe in the after chat.
Absolutely. That episode last week with Kelsey Dion of Shadow Dark fame, one of my favorite episodes, one of my favorite interview guests to date. That was like just really a blast. If you missed that show last week, you should definitely go back in the archives and check it out because, oh my God, that was such a fun time. Big thanks to Kelsey for that. Hopefully we can do more stuff with her and Shadow Dark in the future. And like Paul said, if you're entirely new to the channel, we do have Patreon. We have just great conversations happening around the clock all the time with folks. Our patrons are just the best. Big thanks to our patron supporters like Backweus, who's checking in that we are currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream. So thank you so much for that. And we'll be in that video chat there about 10 minutes into the next hour. To continue the conversation. So, Paul, thank you guys. 2 weeks ago, over the July 4th holiday, which coincides with your birthday nicely, I'm really glad that I got a chance to come up and run a couple of sessions of the classic adventure Lost Caverns of Sajkant. And thank you guys for queuing up for the challenging games, that I tend to run. I don't know if that was news to anybody.
sitting around for 3 days in a row playing some old school D&D with my friends and family is just a delight every single year. Thank you so much for coming up and running that. Super fun. It's a lovely tradition that we've instantiated. I always kind of get a little bit of cold feet as it gets close because I'm like, oh, it's the middle of the summer and a long weekend. I should be outside doing stuff or whatnot. And then inevitably the weather is terrible in one direction or another, right? Either it's storming or it's sweltering hot and you don't want to go outside. So like spending 3 days sitting in the air conditioning and playing some D&D is about as good as you get in early July, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I was watching a little bit of that video this morning and, I just love getting to hang out with all those folks. I see that our good friend Mike Woods is currently in the chat. No, you're awesome, Mike. You're awesome. So now, okay, spoiler. Okay, I'll just say spoiler. We did achieve 80% of a TPK at the end. My games tend to turn into horror games at the end, regardless of what I want to do. There was part of the adventure that was just perfectly set up for that, and that. That executed. So one thing I wanted to do here is that we had a little bit of an audio glitch when we first started streaming, and I had a little bit of a, like, why am I picking this particular adventure? And since that got blanked out, I had one or two questions on my Blue Sky, actually, but I'm surprised you picked that particular adventure. So let me just go through my six bullets of why the cosmos was telling me to run this particular Lost Caverns of Sajkanth adventure here in 2026. So number one, it's the 50th anniversary. The first time that Sajkanth was ever run was at WinterCon 1976. So I thought that was pretty cool that I'm coming back to that 50 years later. When we first ever did a birthday game, Paul, it was so great. I was so excited about it. And that same summer, someone put up a round robin polling for the best ever first edition adventure. And this was a gentleman at Musings from the Moat House that did this. And Sajkanth came out number one, beat out the Giants, beat out Two Mahars, beat out the A series, beat out the U series, came out the number one most favored adventure from that particular old school survey. So I thought that, and it surprised me. I won't kid you.
Yeah.
I was actually surprised that it came out to be number one. So I thought I was missing something. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Number three, it's one of the very few instances where we have the actual tournament text to study. And for me personally, it's the only instance that I know where we actually have not just like some description of what the tournament was like. We have the actual original tournament text and we can examine the differences, and they're huge. They're enormous between the tournament in 76 and the first edition publication in 1982. It's really a fascinating case study in the presentation. Aside from that, it's a fascinating case study in the presentation styles of how adventures got published. And again, there's a very stripped down original, you know, old school version 76. There's a more polished up kind of middle ground evolving advanced D&D version of 82. And then Wizards actually published another adventure just 2 years ago. So in 2024, for the 50th anniversary of D&D, Wizards actually pumped out another revision for 5th edition. So it's kind of interesting to compare all of those things. Number five is Sajkanth is a really key pillar in Gygax's campaign lore. In fact, it was a lot of people kind of focus on that for the lore of the Greyhawk campaign. There's a whole bunch of stuff in the depths of that module that kind of spun out to other stuff. It was, you know, the code on the module that I have in my hands is coded S4, but they had plans to recode it to WG3 as part of the specific World of Greyhawk series. So the plan was you were going to have T1, Village of Hamlet, T2, the Temple of Elemental Evil, WG3, those are going to be WG1, 2, WC3 would be this, and then some other World of Greyhawk modules. They did have a sequel called Thrisdon, right? The Thrisdon Adventure is a direct sequel to it. And then number six, I got to be one of the referees this year at Gary Con at the big Advanced D&D Legends of Role-Playing Tournament. What a joy that was to be included there. 20 different teams, 20 different referees. Harold Johnson was one of them. And the adventure at the AD&D tournament there this year was specifically another sequel to Sajkanth. And in fact, it specifically hooks into one of the areas that you guys adventured in, actually, is another secret exit to another place. And that was specifically the tournament that I got to run this year. So overall, all the stars seem to be aligned, telling me that I should dig into the Sajkanth adventure again here this summer. So I'm really glad I got a chance to. I've never dug into that as much. I've never run it before. I've never dug into it as much as I have here, getting ready for your game. And I'm really glad I got to, you know, try it out at the table.
Awesome, awesome. You know, I have I have some critique to make, and there's a couple of points there in your like reasons for running it that I'd love to dig into. But before we do that, I'm just kind of curious if at a very high level, Dan, having said all that and now been through it, looking back, what are your thoughts? Right? Are you glad you ran it? Would you choose to run again? Like, what's your overall impression of having run it?
I would like to run it again. We didn't get to the second level, so I'm kind of wondering how that would run. I think we had some conversation. you know, we weren't entirely sure exactly who was going to be at the table with us until late. So maybe there's some conversation that maybe this wasn't exactly the right adventure for this group. Maybe, you know, I tend to struggle between the joy of the surprise of what the adventure is versus being transparent about what the adventure and the challenges are going to be. So maybe if I'd advertised in advance what we were going to, like if I was in a different convention and I got to advertise what I was going to run in advance and get people that were specifically opting into this, I'd be interested in seeing how that goes.
That's such an interesting point to make, I think. And I think it relates back to your point of the motivations here of that poll that you're talking about, right? And one of the things that jumps out about me about that poll is that it was specifically held in a Facebook group for enthusiasts of first edition AD&D, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
And I have to say, when I'm looking at old school content, first edition AD&D is a bit of a turnoff, right? I would rather see stuff built basic, built for original. First edition AD&D, I start to go, oh, it's going to be like that, is it? And it's interesting, right? Because I was talking to Rachel about this recently. I can't remember if this was either before or after we played Sajkanth. Probably before, honestly. Maybe it was after. I can't remember. Anyway, point being, Rachel isn't as well versed as us in old school D&D, right? You can see that in the stream. There's a couple of moments where has a more modern 5e approach to things and is a little surprised by the way some of the stuff turns out. And I was explaining about the split in the product line at that time period, right? The basic versus advanced, right? And this gets to where I'm like my personal taste of like, oh, you know, there's a lot of people talk about a lot of different reasons about why it happened or what the, you know, what the differences were. And you can certainly get into like the whole like legal battle between Arneson and Gygax, I think is a strong argument. But you can't help but notice there is sort of this different attitude in the, even just like the opening couple of pages of the earliest publication, right? Of the BX booklet that come, or the rules that come in BX, say, versus the first couple of pages of the Player's Handbook, Dungeon Master's Guide to First Edition AD&D, where basic and original, I get this more of this, this is a toolkit, this is a sandbox, you're the dungeon master, you should leverage your powers to adjust the game to your players' tastes, and you should adjust to your milieu, and this is just, you know, whatever you want to alter is up to you, right? This is just tools for you to build your game. And AD&D, we think, is maybe a little more targeted at the tournament crowd, where it is, these are the rules. This is how you adjudicate fairly across many groups, all playing the same content at the same time, right?
True.
And true. The funny thing is, so the punchline here is Rachel, taking that in, kind of very succinctly said to me, oh, so it's basically yes and versus actually.
You know, Rachel's instincts are great, and that was the first time I got a chance to play with her. I would have Rachel at my table any time of the day. When she filled in, like one of the things I'm most thankful for was she filled in details on all the different bestial faces in the first room, where in the actual text, it's just like there's a dog, there's a cat, etc. So her improv instincts to give me extra details were like exactly what I needed right at that moment. So her instincts are great. I do tend to, when we, you know, I do some improv with my partner Isabel here. Most of the people here in my gaming group in New York have, you know, trained in improv and done stage stuff on that. I do tend to say it's maybe, it's not yes and, it's maybe. We're going to, the dice are frequently going to tell us no. And,
yeah, I could see that. I could see that. Yeah. But I guess I still think that conceptually, basic and original definitely have this more loose reins. The DM is in charge. The DM should adapt mentality, right? Where I think that AD&D has more of a, well, we can't trust an individual DM because we have 20 tables of DMs all running the same content. So we need consistency.
So one of the things, so I might say that I feel like one of the things that biased the play more in that direction, and this is frankly common for all of the early, I might say it's not so much a first edition thing, but it's, but it might be more the fact that all the early adventures came out of tournament play, and they were dual usage. So the Giant series, the A series, this module, all appeared initially in a tournament, in a competitive tournament situation. So yeah, the adventure is set up to be hard, frankly, to be a bit of a meat grinder. And in order for really the elite, you know, tournament players to be identifiable at the end of it. So, you know, I was certainly using original D&D rules.
That's my argument here, right?
Yeah.
This is my argument, and I'm not sure, and maybe it's apocryphal because I've heard this argument made, and I don't know if it's true or not, but the idea being that that kind of play is the target of AD&D First Edition, that these rules were printed to support that play. Disagree with that statement?
Partially, yes. I'm going to say, I feel like a third of the motivation for AD&D was that, yes. Now, Sajkant was run before that. So, at least the original Sajkanth tournament predates first edition. So the way the adventure was set up is more fundamental than the advanced rules that came later, partly to handle that and partly also just to have people be able to move between different home tables as well and coherently. So I do think that maybe it might be a little awkward. You know, all the early adventures are like that, but it might be a little awkward to pull out a hardcore tournament adventure and run it, you know, even if it was just inspired or even just came out of that experience, and run it for people that haven't been in boot camp to train for that type of play session. Now, one thing I'll say is that Right, and I was really surprised by this, is that between the 76 tournament that was original D&D and the 82 publication that was officially advanced D&D, in the dungeon part, so first of all, the original tournament has no wilderness section. And that was all entirely added for the later version. The dungeon segment uses almost, I'm going to say 98%, the exact same maps. The maps are almost exactly the same, with just a couple little key differences. But the contents are wildly different. So, you know, Gary Gygax wrote both, and he did a lot. He swapped out at least 60% of the monsters and the creatures and the traps between the two publications, which really surprised me. It kind of makes a little bit of sense, because in that 82 publication, you basically get a little mini monster manual. You get the adventure, and there's a whole separate booklet here that is like 32 or more pages or whatever it is, that has a whole slew of new monsters and treasures, basically a tiny little new monster manual for advanced D&D. Yep. And many, you know, there's too many things there, but many of them get injected into the dungeons, replacing classic original D&D monsters. And so when I sat down and said, I'm going to run this, I actually had a little bit of a dilemma. We talked about this on our Discord server a little bit. I had a little bit of a dilemma. Which one am I going to run? Am I going to really lean into the original tournament and run that? Or do I want this later, more elaborate publication? And I will say that I did a little bit of mixing matching. What I had available to me wasn't 100% one or the other, but the decision that I made based on knowing that I was going to come up at your place, Paul, was that the wilderness section gave some interesting texture, and overall there were more things to talk to. So as usual, and I feel like I need to, if I'm going to run a pure tournament, I need to tell people this, to keep it fair, usually the monsters are just attack or die, the end.
Yep.
Because you don't want some kind of subjective decision about like, oh, this, you know, DM1 says, oh, I like your shoes, gets you through the encounter, and DM2 says otherwise. So in a pure tournament, it's just like everything's attack or die, frequently mindless. The 82 publication had a lot more intelligent creatures you could talk to, I felt for this audience, that would be appreciated. And that's actually why I picked the 82 version, even though in some ways it might be a little bit harder or the puzzles might be more cryptic.
It's so interesting. I think that this very issue, and we may go down a crazy tangent now and move away from Zanjikan, I apologize for that. But this very issue is clearly something that was wrestled with by the creators of D&D and the people running the tournaments of the time, right? It was clearly something that they wrestled with and changed their minds on. And it's really fascinating. There's lovely little notes about this throughout history. I'll just point out two. Mr. Jordan on our Discord server posted shortly after we ran that an excerpt of designer notes written by Bob Blake of Judges Guild talking about in 1976 or 1978, something like that, of publishing the kind of design philosophy for making tournament games. And he specifically calls out this notion of like, yeah, we had to go with this kind of simplistic design that frankly isn't great, right? He kind of says, do I think this is good design? No, but it is necessary for the level of consistency we need in a tournament.
Yeah.
The other data point I find really interesting is to look at where tournaments went after that. One of the tournaments I look at a lot is Into Forgotten Realms, which was published in Dragon Magazine number 95, written by Ed Greenwood. And this was run at Gen Con 17. That would have been 1984. So not terribly much later. But already you're seeing this weird morph into, no, actually, role play is more important. There's specific notes in the adventure about how it is important to, you know, give the players space to interact with the NPCs or cleverly think their way through problems. And it even boils down to the scoring system, where the scoring system becomes per individual with awards for best role player and stuff like that. And that's, by the time I was going to Gen Con in the early 90s, that was de rigueur, right? That was most of the tournaments I played in at that period. It wasn't the whole team that would move forward. It was one individual from each team would move forward into the next.
Okay. This is one of the things that really baffles me about early tournament play, is their tendency to do that, because that isn't just a late era thing. The Zanjikanth tournament is set up the same way.
I get it. I totally get it. I think that it comes from this tension of, it's a tournament, so we have to be fair and consistent and judge people in the scoring way. But when we remove some of the elements you're talking about that must be removed, like all of the stuff in the wilderness, all of the NPC interactions, all the places where it gets fuzzy and it's just not a clear, distinct line, right? The very notion of, well, the default for all monsters is to just attack. I feel like once you go that road, and I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people playing the games in this period felt this way, that it removes some of the magic of the game, that it makes it less D&D.
Absolutely fair point. I think when Gary initially wrote or ran to Mahar's at Gen Con 2 or whatever it was, there were people criticizing it in the exact same way, is that this is missing something that I expected out of this game that you're presenting. And, you know, maybe it's a little bit of a weakness that all those early adventures came out of the tournament play and are kind of skewed in that direction as a result. But I separate from that, I really dislike, and I'm completely boggled why anybody thought it was a good idea to be promoting in a tournament, to be declaring one player in a team the winner and the rest of that team loses. So I don't know if my mindset just doesn't like that, but I want the team to all be pulling together and not be trying to sabotage each other in some weird way. I really don't like that.
I 100% agree. I feel like it's this naive adaptation of like, well, this is how board game tournaments go, or other competitive, tabletop games go.
Like, poker. Okay. You might have a bunch of tables at poker and you're eliminating people as you go, and then you bring together. Yeah. Okay. All right.
It's
not like a football. It's not like soccer. It's not like baseball. It's like that if you're, you don't have teams in poker. right? You don't have teams in those board games. I'm a team. I want, they should advance together. It seems obvious to me.
I see it as evidence that they saw this as a problem and they were trying to solve it. And they made a ham-fisted choice that was not the right solution. Obviously, Dan, the correct solution is to have consistent DMs across teams, preferably two, so you can have both an arbiter and a nemesis or adversary character. That is clearly the right way to run a D&D tournament.
It's hard to get that many. What I totally agree. Obviously, your argument is unassailable, Paul. Obviously, it's backed up by hard scientific evidence. The one thing is, it's hard to get, for a big tournament, it's hard to get that many DMs. Paul Stormberg, who runs the Legends of Roleplaying at GaryCon, getting 20 DMs that he feels he can trust and are going to give people a good experience and try to give them a fun time is already quite a burden to him. So if we were to double that, he might not be able to make that happen.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, that's why I'm saying the solution is to just have two DMs and they run all the games. So every game is run by a consistent DM. That's what I'm
okay. Pushing. Well, there you go. Yeah. That would be excellent. That would be ideal.
And viewers from new viewers may not realize I'm of course referring to The Big Bad, a miniseries that Dan and I developed here on this very channel. Please check it out. You can see how I think a proper
We co-DM together quite frequently, so we have a lot of background. It works super great, and we love doing it that way.
What would you like to dig into, Dan? We're already about halfway into this episode. What is interesting to critique?
Okay, so we should point out here that one day after I came back from your place, we discovered to our mutual amazement that you had read and reviewed Sajkanth. On your blog, Paul's Game Blog, yep, featured a review of Sajkanth in 2011, 15 years ago, and I had no knowledge of that, and you had no recollection that you'd read the whole thing and reviewed it. And at the time, you said, this looks like a great adventure.
the craziest thing about that for me is the day before you discovered that and pointed it out, right? I think the very morning after we played. No, it must have been right after you left. Right after you left on Sunday, I got out the module and read it to find out what did we miss. And let me, get some understand of I was struggling a lot with trying to decide, do I think that this is bad content or did I just have a frustrating time because I didn't do well? And I read a bunch of the module and I had zero recollection of ever having read it before. So when you pointed out that That's I had amazing. Written an entire review of it, I was flabbergasted because I had no recollection. While I was reading it, while I was sitting there reading it, none of it looked familiar to me. And maybe that's the most damning part of that story is clearly it didn't leave a very lasting impression on me.
Amazing.
15 years ago when I read it. I will say in retrospect, it reads probably better than it plays. And I could see reading through it that it feels like a good, a better module than it is. And it was also, 2011. I was very early in my exposure to old school D&D. I was, and I recommend anyone who's going back and reading that review, also read the subsequent two posts. Because right after that, I did a post on Gygaxian naturalism and pointed this out as an example of it. And then after that, I reviewed, I think, WG4, maybe?
Yep.
And then made some comparisons to Sajkanth and some comments on it. And interestingly, one of my final takes before I move off from that topic was that I thought it would be great for campaign play, but probably not a good tournament.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's what 2011 Paul thought.
Anyway. Right. Yes. Understood.
I could. And I could see that, understood. Right? Because it has. That's one of my big critiques of it is when you look at the maps, there's a ton of content. Which is good generally. I think you should, if you're running time limited content, you should have more content than the players can see. Gives them choice about how they go and move about it, and that's exciting. But there's a ton of stuff here that's clearly there for time wasting. there's a lot of twisty, windy passages that go nowhere. There's, if we talk about the outdoor section, and that's very interesting that it wasn't even included in the tournament, which I think is reasonable. Here, I'll just throw them. This is the player's map. I adore a player's map. I love when a module says, here's an incomplete map. Good luck, players. Off you go. And so I was excited to see this. But if you sit with this map for a minute, you'll realize it's a terrible map. There is nothing on this map except lines and points with numbers on them. The terrain is all the same. There is no, it's just mountains. It's just mountains, the end. And then a path running through it and a bunch of numbers. Pick which number you want to go to. There's really, there's nothing here that's leading me to make any kind of decisions whatsoever. I don't know that having this map adds to my play in any way. And then to go back to the, there's a bunch of time-wasting content here, of course, is the fact that the very first intersection you get to, if you turn right, you end up at the dungeon. And so if you just make a lucky guess on the very first decision, you're done. And the rest of the map, the whole top half of the map, just don't bother with it.
Okay, so my take would be, yeah, the wilderness part is clearly not part of the tournament, right? So the wilderness part is obviously for campaign play, and it gives you some additional details about particular borders in the Greyhawk area. Again, I do think that some of the fondness for the adventure is the rather large depth of like Greyhawk lore and info you get there. Now, again, the actual trail. There's a couple of minor trails there. And to be clear, if you were to go back to the player's map, the trail to the dungeon isn't on the player's map. So can't.
But it is that first intersection. You come to that first intersection. Player's map says go left or right, and then when we look at the DM's map, we see that's actually a four-way intersection. So there's a right turn that's just not on the player's map.
Right.
We of course circumvented that. We heard rumors of there's a big army of hobgoblins there. We thought we should avoid that. Mm-hmm. So then if I don't know if that right hand turn, and Dan, maybe you know the content better than I at this point, is it hidden? Do I have to search for that path?
Okay.
Or do I get there and go, wait a minute, there's four ways to go and not three?
I had to fill that in. Okay, so I had to make so that's actually not addressed in the text. And I made a call that it was hidden, and I had a particular role for a search check, frankly, to find it. Same thing with that second branch that led you to the Brigands Valley, where you get the flying hippogriffs. Yep. That's also hidden, and made some search rolls, and one of the characters did find that one. And that was how I was, that's how I was handling that. There's also at least, and for what it's worth, for thinking about the time that we had available, what I'd done is I had effectively, in the actual adventure, the things that get stocked on all the different encounter areas that we're looking at here, both the numbered areas and all the dots, could be random rolls. There's 20 encounters, and it's up to the DM to either roll or place them. So for what we were going to do, I sat down and I did carefully decide where all 20 areas were going to go. And one of the things is an uncrossable avalanche that I decided to put right in the center point of this map, thereby cutting off this whole sequence to the lower bot, to the lower half. Yep. And in that lower half, there's at least three different things that you can run into that can direct you to where the dungeon is. So depending on where you were going to go at the end of every branch, there was somebody who could, if you didn't just murder them, direct you to where the dungeon was going to be.
And this is overall, my argument here is that I think those are great edits. Fantastic edits. Very wise, especially given that we were not quite playing in the 4-hour time constrained tournament, but we were certainly in a time constrained setting.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, right? When I look back at my old review, if I imagine running this in an open-ended campaign where we're just coming back and playing again and again and again ad infinitum forever, well then having more space to just roam around and explore becomes more enticing. You're more, right? I think that as players, you're even rewarded, frankly, for being more completionist,
exploring more space, more treasure, more experience.
That's why I think that. Yeah, exactly. That's why I think that it's more suited for that style of play. Once you put in the time constraint, I start to become frustrated by these elements because I know that now the way the game has played is shifted to if it's not the goal, ignore it. You have to, as quickly as you can, move through the time wasters and get to the thing. So this problem, I think, of no real lots of options with no real information to guide you whatsoever. I think it's repeated both here in the wilderness map and then again in our level one of the dungeon, where the very first thing you come into is this big cave on the bottom center there with, was it 6 or 7 different options of directions to go, one of which is the right one that leads further and deeper into the dungeon, and all the rest are dead ends that go into nothing helpful.
Okay,
and
so
frankly,
let me just. So
there's a clue here of which one's the right one, but it is so obtuse. I suspect that most people who did well at this tournament did well because they luckily, or you know, somehow through a heavy dose of luck, went the correct direction right off the bat.
And I differ. We chatted a bit after we got done playing, and I don't have the same opinion. Couldn't hurt. Before we get off the wilderness, right?
Yeah.
I just want to say that, you know, not everything is a time waster. And part of the reason why I wanted to run a cut down wilderness is to give a taste of that, of almost everything there is something that you can talk to or negotiate with, which I thought would be appealing for our particular game group. And so there's a bunch of things that can help, that can assist you if you interact with them the right way. So
okay, all right, you want to talk about the underground?
Yeah, okay, so here's what I want to say about so once we get to the dungeon part, I just want to share my the number one experience that I had as DM with you guys running it, is it seemed over and over again to me like an amazing magic trick that it perfectly screwed with your intuitions at every single turn. So every single turn, it seemed like some magician had sat down, thought about your specific instincts, and then designed this in advance exactly to turn you the wrong way. And I was truly amazed again and again and again and again that what your best attempts at decoding what, you know, how you were going to get around these challenges lured you into worse situations almost every single time. And I was like, you know, marveling at the magic trick. And so again, you know, they'd been running a bunch of adventures, and, you know, Gygax was in the frame of mind where I'm going to specifically try to foil the player's strategies. And I never expected it to work so exactly perfectly well at almost every single turn to trick you into making the wrong choice. And
that's so interesting. The question I would have is, was that the way it foiled our intuition? Do you think that was by design by Gygax when he authored this, or just bad luck?
It was so, okay, to begin with, I was thinking bad luck. And then when it happened again and again and again and again and again, I was like, there is some kind of magic trick happening here that I was not privy to in advance. And it was so uniform that it seemed like either it was just something set up about it to entangle with all your guys' gaming, with all your guys' D&D instincts, that I came around to thinking that this must be this must be intentional in a way that I didn't see in the design initially.
And that was my assumption in the moment. And that's why I was making arguments at the time of this is like earworm level design, right? This is, the players are used to foiling, finding out what's there by pressing their ear on the door. Therefore, I'm going to put a bunch of worms in the door to, burrow into their brains and cause them problems.
Yeah.
It's that sort of, I don't know what to call it, right? That design mechanism of the players are starting to learn the rules, so now I'm going to change the rules to screw with them.
Now, I don't think it got to that extent, right? There aren't rules being changed here. It seems to me like all fair game components of a D&D dungeon. Yep. It's just that it's laid out and presented in ways to trick you.
Technically accurate, yes. But the spirit of it is intentionally to twist the knife and to make it feel capricious.
That is correct. And, if we think about like the southern part of the map that we're looking at right here, everything below the river, it's absolutely the challenge is, can you just get out of that first section? And the proper way is, that southern limb around the south and around the southern end and then up the eastern end. Can you get out of that without wasting time in all these tangled up tunnels? That is absolutely intentionally designed as a time waster to test you.
Yeah.
As an aside, right, I just want to say that's explicit. If you read, and we had an episode about the Gygax's advice for adventuring in the very end pages of the first edition Player's Handbook, he says that out loud, that DMs are going to try to do that. And the Legends of Role-Playing Tournament this year at GaryCon, Paul Stormborg wrote it the same way, right? He said out loud, there's a whole bunch of interesting, fascinating detail that I put in these rules, in these rooms, specifically to cost you time if the DM reads them out. So you go into a particular place that wasn't necessary for you, and we're absolutely charging you time as the DM reads out all these interesting details. So still today in 2026, if you queue up for an advanced D&D tournament, they're still going to apply that same pressure.
Yeah. I agree, and this is why I won't sign up for such tournaments. That feels to me, you've taken the game of D&D that I love and stripped out the best parts for the sake of competition.
This is one of the places where Paul and I differ in our preferences quite a bit. I love tournament play. It's my favorite way to play D&D. The Legends of Roleplaying at GaryCon is growing every year. They're going to need more DMs this year. And it's a play style that Paul doesn't like.
Okay, having read and run multiple old school tournament adventures, and in fact, both of us can now say that.
Yeah.
In your opinion, what's the best one?
I will. I'm very fond of this one. I like the fact that we can see the original tournament, and we can absolutely see that the content is totally. Just talking to the dungeons, right? Let's ignore the wilderness because that was not part of the tournament. But if we just look at the two levels of the dungeons, it's very specifically designed for 2 4-hour slots. And to my knowledge, there's no other classic adventure that clearly delineates exactly what's going to be happening in the tournament section. And I was talking to Max afterwards. Maybe it would have been better to be more explicit about that if you're going to embrace that. Maybe I should have dug up the 76 version of the tournament, explicated how you're going to get scored, and leaned into that more would have been better than less. And I actually am quite fond of this, and I would like to run it again. Compared to the Giants, which is way too much to do in one session, right? That clearly is just this elaborate thing. The actual tournament players didn't get to like a third of the content. And it's clearly, that clearly wasn't actually fine-tuned for a tournament. This was. So I think I might actually prefer this, I think.
I would bring up for a better or more documented version of tournament play, Now, granted, you're correct, right? I've not seen any other case where you can go and find the PDF of the original text that was given to the tournament runners. That's like,
right?
That is gold, absolutely. The A series, though, is pretty good at calling out this was part of the original tournament. This was not, right?
Yeah.
Highlight the map to show you what was included in the original tournament. There's notes in the modules about what was included in the original tournament. For me,
I count that as number two.
For me, I would actually say A4 is particularly the best of the tournament modules.
Okay, interesting. Yep, good. That's a strong argument.
The earlier AE series are good, but they're a little linear. They go a little bit too much in the opposite direction of this one. This one, I'm not crazy about all the twists and turns, and now I'm lost, and it's just here to waste my time. The A series is, oh no, you get set piece, go, and how far can you get through this very linear progression of encounters? Okay, but that feels pretty railroady. I think A4, in addition to just being super clever about we stripped all your equipment and now you have to figure out how to make it through with no spells and no equipment. You look at the map, there are a couple of choices to make. And there are multiple exits, so there's multiple win conditions. Yeah. I feel like it's set up nicely to be like just a good solid tournament experience where different people who play it will have slightly different paths through it. They'll experience it slightly differently, but you're never in this just headbanging frustration of I feel like I'm getting nowhere.
A4 is great. Absolutely. The A series is pretty good about delineating what the tournament would have looked like. To me, the surprising thing with Sajkanth is, wow, the monsters are totally different. The contents are wildly different. So now I'm left wondering for the other A modules, like how different were they between the tournament and the publication?
I will say Sajkanth, there's a lot more combat in Sajkanth than pretty much any other tournament I've seen. There's a lot more fights.
Interesting. That's an interesting take.
Certainly, if you compare it to, I don't know, I mean, unfair to, I suppose, compare it to
less than the G's, Tomb of Heart, I would say. Which,
really? Is it less than the G's?
Oh,
I felt like there was.
I think.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot. I guess that's true. I'd have to go back and reread the G series.
Yeah, like, G3 is just like one solid melee, basically. It's just one nonstop melee.
That's fair.
Yeah, and I will say that so like when I was as one of the referees at GaryCon this year, and I think it's a really great experience, is that you know my particular group did about halfway, right? So there's a navigation puzzle, same thematics, frankly, and my team had figured it out. They more or less got halfway through, and then they did actually get stuck at one point. I think there were teams. There was probably some team that just never even began to figure out what they had to do. And then when we gathered as a bunch of DMs, there were three groups that figured the whole thing out. And they said, just cleave through it in half the time. Like we had 4 hours and there were like a couple of groups that just figured out 2 hours later, we're done. We get all the points. And then we had to have a debate about the three teams that all scored the max score, how we were going to decide which one was the winner. So I my instinct is also that if we threw 20 teams at Sajkanth, at least one or two of them would just figure it out and might very well have gotten through the whole thing.
I think they might luck. They might luck into going down the correct corridor, but I don't know about figure it out. I think that initial hint, the puzzle in the very first room with the faces that talk to you, but maybe not, that is so obtuse. I feel like it's like a classic riddle. It's exactly like what Direct Sun about riddles in games. You either know it because you knew it, or just your brain just connected the dots immediately, or you don't, and it's just going to be frustrating.
Okay, so I feel that your instinct, right, that was what was going to happen, was playing against you at the time. So my feeling that like, oh, it's a bunch of guys acting and time-wasting nonsense was specifically one of the things that was hurting you at the play. And there were at least four different places in that initial section that could have directed you to the right exit. And when I was reviewing that entry in the video, it was Mike specifically interesting. So two interesting things I saw in the video this morning was when you entered there, it was Mike that looked at the faces and said, this is the first puzzle that we have to figure out. And then about 2 minutes later, he said, maybe we should talk to them. And the thing is at that point, you'd seen the differently colored gems down the throats, and that threw you off. And now you were focused on the different colors of the gems. That's a legitimate herring. And you never followed up on the suggestion, maybe we should talk to them directly. That never happened, if I'm recalling correctly.
Yeah, I mean, I was probably a little led astray from thinking like, oh, it's a magic mouth spell, which we all know just plays one programmed message, the end. Also, from reading the text, I know that the majority of things you say to them, they will not respond. It is only if you think of the very special, clever phrase to give them or word to give them.
Sure.
Otherwise, they just repeat their same message, which again is going to lead you in that direction of thinking, oh, it's just a magic mouth. They're just programmed to say the same thing over and over again.
You know, never got to that point. So we don't, you know, as DM, I don't know. Never talked to them. You know, didn't the verse that you're given is very cryptic, very hard to figure out. I get it.
Is there a clue in that verse? I kept rereading it. Sure. And even rereading the module myself, I could not find the connective tissue about what that verse had to do with anything in the dungeon.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you want me to tell you?
I
told you that Saturday. You're not going to like this.
Yeah.
So it says, look over your shoulder. So part of it says, look over your shoulder as you start. Well, in the game, I think at Rachel's instinct, you walked all the way outside and looked over your shoulder. Well, if you walk into that entry cave and look over your right shoulder, that's the exit tunnel.
Oh, geez. But you're not going to know that unless you're staring at the map.
The exit tunnel is over your shoulder as you walk into it, as you start there.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Because I'm coming from the south, the exit tunnel also technically leads south.
Yes.
So we would have to double back the way you came.
Yeah. Now, if you look over your left shoulder, there's no tunnel there. There's just a wall. But if you look over your right, so if you watch the replay, maybe a little bit later on, I started to once in a while go, like people were saying, what shoulder? You know, I go, you look over your shoulder. Which shoulder? That might be important sometime. What shoulder? Again, very cryptic. I don't expect anybody to pick up for that. But that is what that clue is saying, is if you walk into that cave, look over your right shoulder. That's the proper exit. In the tournament, and this is something I was going to follow through with, the golem has a map of the whole southern section on its back, engraved on its back. So if you got into a point of ever looking at the back of the golem, again, that was actually taken out of the 82 publication, but I was going to use it here because that is part of the tournament.
You were going to use it. And so what, we just never happened to catch a glimpse of its back because we ran away from it? Okay.
So a couple things. I will say maybe something that made it harder is the giant bat cave, which is number 4. It's right on the left-hand side of this map. It's just below the river. So in the 82 publication, as you can see on this map here, there's a connection high up in the bat cave to the river. That doesn't exist in the tournament. And I think that's a big problem in the 82 because it makes the initial puzzle not make any sense anymore. If you do talk to the faces, you can get one of them to say, I barred the only way. And that doesn't make any sense on this map because there's actually two ways. So that one, I switched back to the tournament and had only one way out to make that puzzle actually be coherent. Maybe for campaign play, you want more than one way, but then you need to change the wording of the riddle. Wizards actually did that in the 2024 version. They had to change the wording of the riddle to match the map now.
I mean, that room, too, was perfectly set up to foil exactly our strategy at that moment, which was to have an invisible, silent forward scout. And sure enough, you've got a completely dark room full of sonic echolocating monsters. Oof, I just got rained down on so hard in that first encounter. I was just like, wow, really okay, these combats are going to be super hard. I need to not get involved. I need to back
There's a bunch of stuff. Yeah, and I mean, and I will say that there's a bunch of stuff that could at least potentially foil invisible scouting for one reason or another. So that was, you're probably going to have that experience at some point, one way or the other.
Well, Dan, we are out of time. I know that there's a dozen things we didn't get to talk about here that we probably would have liked to. There was a call out in the chat there to discuss poisonous cloaks, but we're just going to have to save that for the after chat, I think.
Yeah, thank you. Great chat. I wish there is a lot more to talk about here. Let me just say that one of the things that really amused me looking at the video is right at the start, Tanya rolled up a wand of cold, wand of frost, right? And you are on record explaining to Tanya what a wand of cold does. Makes a big cone, frost. You're going to roll a whole bunch of d6 of damage. And she says, "Oh, that's interesting." And you, Paul, say, "Yeah, it's great." Not realizing that later on that was the thing that was going to kill you.
I still think it was the right choice at the time. And it's certainly when one visualizes a cone coming out of a wand, you could see maybe it would pass over a downed friend. I would have taken that same risk. I do not blame her at all for that one.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think it was
uncanny.
It was just a wild, uncanny way
that things worked out. Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
All right. Well, and anything else you want to wrap up with here, Dan, before I toss it to the viewers?
I'd like if anybody has, you know, comments about the choices that I made as DM. I was mixing matching. I was, you know, making some edits between OD&D and AD&D and stuff like that. If you had comments about, you know, things you think that could have been run better, I am, you know, it whet my appetite. Just like Tomb of Horrors, I want to run that again for people that are, you know, haven't studied it from end to end yet. So I might run that or Sajkant at a convention sometime in the future. And I'm actually really anticipating the next time I run it, frankly.
Nice. All right. Viewers, if you have opinions on Sajkanth, anything you saw happen in any of the streams, mistakes we made, areas where you feel, do you feel like you have comments on Dan's interpretation of the text, either agree or disagree, please leave us a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe we'll return to this because there's certainly, as I said, quite a few topics here that we didn't quite get.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like and follow and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and TikTok and Loops and GitHub. And we have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and anatomize that like button. Please.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please consider leaving us a 5-star review. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, as usual, a huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said earlier, every tier, even the $1 tier, gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues around the clock 24/7. And we have the smartest patrons in all the land. And I'm continually thunderstruck by their great ideas and their great interpretations for old D&D and new D&D and horror games and science fiction and miniatures. And just, oh my God, the things that they make and create are just amazing. So we will be there in about 10 minutes on our Discord server for our live video after chat to continue the conversation. I have other things to say. Paul, I think, has other things to say. There's some great chat comments that we didn't get to here. It might be a tiny little bit more spicy than we were willing to talk about here in public. I don't know. That might happen today. We would love for you to join us as a patron on Discord server. So am I forgetting? What am I? Does that basically wrap it up, Paul? Or is there other stuff we had?
I think you've got it, Dan.
Okay, fantastic. That's what a great day. I'm so glad we had this conversation. I'm so glad we had new people tune in to watch that today. So don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.